Hello everyone, welcome to North and South Podcasts. This is Tim. This is a creativity podcast. Please follow me on Twitter at North Podcasts. And don't forget to contribute financially if you can through coffee.com, which is all in the notes. Please share and spread the word about the podcast too. Today I am talking to C.A. Snellgrove, who is a published children's author and taxi driver. I've known Christopher since we were very young, about 11 or 12 years of age. We went to school together, we played cricket together. We're going to talk about his fantastic book, The White Barbados. Check it out. There'll be links in the notes with the podcast. The White Barbados, great book. I like it. My son likes it. How did you get to a position where your book that you've written is published and available? What's that journey been like?
Firstly, thanks for having me here on the podcast, Tim.
My pleasure.
It's a real pleasure to be here. How the White Barbados came about, tenacity, hard work, many, many knockbacks. It's so difficult to get published in this industry. You usually have to be either Oxford or Cambridge educated and know somebody in the know. Because when I finished The White Barbados, which was in 2007, there was, at the time of edit, there was 256 publishers in the Western world, being the UK, the US, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and there was 171 different agents. Now, to get a publisher, you had to have had an agent, and they only dealt with published authors who've got agents, but agents would only take you on if you'd only been published.
Yeah.
So that was the catch 22 of the 171 agents that say, oh, well, we'll take you on if you've already been published. Oh no, I haven't been published. So you go to a publisher and you'd say, have you got an agent? Oh no. Oh no, we only take people who've got an agent. So that was, it was really difficult, and I just kept on applying. And there was an old friend of mine who was a managing director of an investment bank, and he was looking into investing into things that were creative, like creativity. And we were in the San Fermín Festival in Pamplona in 2016, and he just asked randomly, you've written stuff, haven't you? And I said, I've written all kinds of nonsense over the years. And he said, what's your magnum opus? What is your greatest piece of work? And I said, it's probably The White Barbados. And he said, what's The White Barbados? I said, oh, it's a children's book. It's like a children's love story, if you like, about a mythical woodland creature with lots of legs. And he said, oh, you'll have to send it to me. And I said, are you sure you don't want me to recite it to you, word for word? He said, how long is it? And I said, well, it's 58 stanzas, and it's written a non-perfect ballad. That's where the second line and the fourth line will rhyme, but the first and third don't. If the first and third do, that's then a perfect ballad. But and he said, yeah, if we've got time, how long is it? And I said, it's 7.5 minutes. We got another beer, and we sat there in the Mediterranean sun, and I reeled it off. And he said to me, two things. Firstly, this shouldn't be scrumpled up in a drawer in your house. And secondly, this has to be made. He said, it'll take a while to do, but one thing I want to know is, what do you want to do from it? Do you want to make a profit, or do you want to get it shared? And I said, neither. I want to get it right, because that's the thing. We need to be working with the right people in the right place at the right time. And he said, I'll have a look at different business models and different publishers. And rather than going through a conventional publisher, we'll set up our own publishing company. We'll do it that way. And we'll give it away for free as an ebook, because people believe in reciprocation, because reciprocation is innate. If you feel someone's give you something and they've done a good deed, it's it, people in the world are good in general, they're good. That's how that came about. So it started in 2016, so finished in 2007, got just under 10 years worth of knockbacks. And the whole process started in 2016. We met up at the start of 2021 and we decided that 2021 was about getting it right. And this year, 2022, is about getting it shared. So that's how that come about, yeah.
Fantastic. So we're talking 14 years between you writing it and it getting out there. And someone saying, right, come on, tell me it. You said it to this person and that person's heard it and said, we've got to get this out there. Now, you said that you were going through that traditional route for a long time. It was a bit of a catch-22. You know, I'm sure people listening to this might have this romantic idea that someone writes a children's book, they put it together, and then they might ask a publisher to publish it, and the publisher might go, oh yeah, this is really good, we'll do it. Or they might say, oh no, we don't think it's good enough yet, or whatever, or it never is good enough. But it's obviously a very, very complex thing that you've got to go through. You've got to do your... I mean, we've spoken about this before. You've talked about like the importance of getting it right, the page length, what you want it to do, who's it aimed at, etc. Were these things that you learned through trying to get the White Barbados published, did you have to adapt it and change it to make it better, to make it more right, as you said, or did you do your research before you wrote it?
Probably a little bit of both. I've learned so much about myself and my writing style and the flow of, especially with picture books. There's an awful lot of picture book authors that have never taken ownership of being a picture book author. Like Dr. Zeus or Dr. Zeus, however you want to pronounce his name here, Theodore Gisel, was a journalist and he seemed to scoff at the idea of being anything but the journalist. And come on, mate, people only know you because of the Cat in the Hat and the Grinch, do you know what I mean? Take ownership of it. There was a guy who wrote Guess How Much I Love You, sold 50 million copies, but he was also a journalist and a playwright and a singer and an actor. And, you know, just there just seems to be people who don't take ownership of the picture book world. And I do it. If I never do anything else and I'm only forever and a day known as the guy who created the White Barbados, that's something that I'm at peace with. But something that you asked before about people having this romantic idea of you write a story and you go to a publisher, the publisher won't even read it. Publishers don't even read it because all they're looking for is for sausage meat to put their casing around. Because every book in every bookshop everywhere in the world is just tied up capital, and that's how they see it as. So if you were to come up with a really good, or anyone listening to this was to come up with a really, really good children's book that would work, that children would love anywhere, and nobody's heard of them, they haven't got any sort of backing from anywhere, they haven't got anybody giving them any sort of support, like the support of a local school or a reading club or a library, if they haven't got anything like that, they just won't read it at all. Whereas, no disrespect to Julia Donaldson, Julia Donaldson's the queen of this industry, she's created the Gruffalo. If Julia Donaldson was to write a story about a chimney pot that come to life, that had a little chimney pot face or whatever, again, the publishers wouldn't read it, they wouldn't edit it, but they'd publish it in a heartbeat because they know she's already got an audience. And I think that's what's difficult. And I don't want to say that to try and put people off, because I want more people to be writing and reading and be part of the this world. But there was something that John Steinbeck once said was, when you're writing something, don't get over focused going to end. Just carry on writing, writing away, and just in enjoying what it is that you're doing. And sometimes there is an awful lot of luck and there's an awful lot of serendipity that comes involved as well. you've just got to carry on, and you never know. You look at J.K. Rowling as the most successful children's author. I know it is in novellas, but the most successful children's author of all time. Nobody even read it. They didn't want to read it. It was only that in Australia, it was either Australia Puffin or Penguin. I know it was one of the seabirds. One of the seabird publishers went into their adult market was going into the children's market. So they seen this manuscript and thought, oh, we'll give it a go. She was knocked back by hundreds. She wasn't of that world. She wasn't of that alumni. But if her great-grandfather would have been, I don't know, Oscar Wilde, then she'd have been published 20 years earlier.
That's fascinating, that, because I was listening to a podcast recently about classical music, and this guy said that, you know, you might be able to reel off some names of some famous classical musicians going back through history, he said, but they were a very, very, very small percentage of all the classical musicians who wrote symphonies, etc. at the time. And so much just disappears into history. And yet, you know, you'd like to think that there's a meritocratic dimension to a lot of this. But again, you know, a lot of it is luck, being in the right place at the right time. I mean, I've wrote a children's book for my niece and nephew, and I've shared it with you.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said, oh, this is quite good. It just came to me one day because of something that my niece was into. And I sent it to you, and you straight away went, I like this. He said, but by the way, now, because you've a published author and you've got that experience, I can then take that on board and go, then I can trial it with a group of people. If I was to then go to a publisher, go, I've spoken to another children's author who's looked at this and given me loads of advice. This is a great book. I took it to these people and they've liked it. Then their ears might prick up a little bit
they will do a little bit more. But if you did give me your children's book, if I remember rightly, it's called Willow and the Whale.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
There we go.
Well remembered.
Yeah, so Willow and the Whale. If you did give me Willow and the Whale 10 years ago, me opinion and me critique would have been pretty similar to what it's been after I've been published. Yeah. But there's things that I know now that I wouldn't have known then, but at the same time I wouldn't have had the same amount of credence.
Yeah.
Than what, even though 10 years ago the White Barbados was no different than what it is now. It's just that the flow is better and the cadence is better and the page numbers, that was a thing of, if you were to look and to buy a children's picture book for age 4 to 8 year olds, as soon as you see that it's anything other than 32 pages, it wouldn't have been professionally done and it'll have been rushed. It'd be rushed and it'll be the eager. 32 pages is that's the ultimate.
Yeah.
That is the gold medal of getting it right. It's just a blueprint for all of them to get right. Now, if you're doing a children's picture book and it's 40-45 pages long, you're losing your audience. If it's only 17 pages long, as soon as you're finished, you want another book.
Yeah.
It's about getting that right length.
Yeah.
And
if you haven't done that, they'll think, oh, they haven't done the research in the first place.
Oh, there was... If my company, Barbados Limited, in the future, after I'd done other pieces of work, went into the realms of them publishing other books for other authors, other picture books, no matter how good they were, if they came to me with anything that was any less than 32 pages or any more than 32 pages, I wouldn't read it. If I was inundated, I'd probably have someone there saying, just give me all the ones that are 32 pages. Now, if this goes out and this goes viral everywhere, and everyone's listening to the wonderful North and South podcast, everyone's only ever going to give me stuff that's 32 pages. But the idea, it's not forcing or shoehorning your story into 32 pages. It has to have a flow, but there's pages that may only have a couple of words or no words at all.
Yeah. I noticed that you've got two pages, haven't you, with one word. There's twice in your book, there's a double page with one word on. Or yeah, pretty much.
There's one word I've got one word on, and one word where I've got two words on. It says, everyone's scared, and then there's the ellipses, ... Yeah. Everyone's scared, ... If I'd have went to Macmillan Publishers, Faber and Faber, HarperCollins, Penguin, Lady Bird, any of the big hitters of the, yeah, they'd have never let me do that.
But they're nice. They're nice because you've got this like lovely rhyme and verse, and then you turn the page and something profound happens. It's like,
it's
that's important. And it gives you that natural break. I don't understand why they wouldn't want to do that.
The reason why they wouldn't want to do it is because it's risky, because it's not usually done. These top publishers, they're not about taking risk. They're about being solid and steady. As we touched on before, J.K. Rowling, no one wants to take a risk with it. And if they were being honest, and if you were to say to one of these publishers, oh, you missed the trick there, not getting J.K. Rowling on board, they'd say, honestly, no we didn't, because it was risky, and we don't take risks. We deal in the slow and steady and getting things right, because they're not gamblers.
Yeah.
They're not gamblers, and Macmillan Publishing, to take the white Barbados, and I can say this now, but when I've got like a nice knockback letter, oh thanks, your story was lovely, but at this time, blah blah blah. Yeah. It's the usual
standard. Yeah.
It's the standard. It's a standard knockback of what they give. If they could go back, no matter how many the white Barbados sells, it's a risk.
Yeah.
It's a risk because nobody knows me. I'm not an old Etonian. I'm not Oxford or Cambridge educated. I don't have anyone who was given any constructive criticism, or I haven't got any decent critique in any way, shape or form.
So that's just the way it goes.
That's sadly just the way it goes. They're not willing to take risks. Mm. It's the same with anything new. People, and especially publishers, I mean, I don't know about other industries, but I certainly know in the publishing industry, they just don't want to take a risk.
Yeah, you could say that about a lot of bureaucracies and systems. They don't like going beyond those systems. I mean, even if you look at, say, like energy companies, you know, they've literally had to be dragged to the idea of renewable energy and moving to like that's just the way it was done. And it's the same with most people. You say to someone, yeah, why don't you think about this? There's an immediate reaction against it. And it's the same in the industries. But that perseverance you had to get it published, obviously, you know, I'd recommend anyone to read The White Barbados, to buy it for people. I read it to my 2-year-old son. He loves it. He wants to go back to it. My dad's read it and said, oh, that's a good book. I've read it. There's things in it for the adults, for the kids, different age ranges. And, you know, you've said it's a love story. It's also about rejection. It's about kind of prejudice, discrimination. It's about fitting in. It's about, you know, thinking that there's no one for you, and then it kind of happens later on. It's about, like, difference. It's a good story. It rhymes. There's a lot going on in there. And like, how would you sum it up? Because, you know, there's a lot of things happening in The White Barbados. I thought, oh, this is a great book at so many levels. How would you sum it up?
I'd sum it up as about being about a misunderstood character, being a misunderstood creature. I think we live in a world where there is so much prejudice and so much judgment without curiosity.
Yeah.
There's too many people in the world that will judge indifference, whether it's the different colour of someone's skin, or the different language that they speak, or the religion that they've got, or the upbringing that they've had, or the way they look. And rather than judging people who are different, why are we never curious? Why don't Now, the curious ask questions, but the judgmental don't. The judgmental point fingers. And so at the start, I'm not giving too much away from it, but at the start of The White Bobbitus, we see there's so many people and creatures that are just frightened, and fear turns to hate. We see it in sort of modern day politics. It's the politically, the spectrum used to be the left and the right, the rich and the poor, whereas we seem to have a change in the landscape of the sort of the indigenous and the non-indigenous, the people who feel like they belong and the people who feel like they don't belong, and it's a scary landscape that's changed. So I think for me, my White Bobbitus was a creature who was judged by the judgmental, who pointed the finger.
That's a fantastic message. And in many ways, you know, like, you get that classic Reagan aspect that, like, art shouldn't be political, which is basically saying to people who write plays and books and all that, don't criticise me, you know what I mean? Yeah. But in a society, it's healthy to have, you know, criticism, healthy criticism, curiosity, can we do things better, can we take this further? Nowadays, it's less about what people believe in as to, like, what they're opposed to, like a fear of the other.
Yeah.
And The White Bobbitus is about the fear of the other. Now, The White Bobbitus isn't a political book formally, but there are political themes in it, which some might say, oh, look at this theme and that theme, and that's what's so strong about it as well, because it's a damn fine story, it's a love story. You know, my two-year-old son likes it. For him, he doesn't understand the concept of the other yet, at the level that we might do.
Because it's layered, I was hoping to layer it for that reason.
Yeah, but all the best books and the best articles do that. But that message of, you know, children's books are some of the best books I've read about themes which I think a lot of adults have just simply forgotten. I mean, you just read, like, the average children's novel, you go, there's a message in this, there's something for the adults. And you could actually go out into the street, and most adults going past seem to have forgotten sometimes that innocence and that curiosity, because it's a coping mechanism. This is what I know, like Plato in the cave. All I know is the shadows on the back of the cave, and that's all I'm about. And I think that The White Bobbitus, it's an exploration of that. That's what it's like at that kind of, like, really high level. Do you know what I mean? But, you know, it's a great story as well. Do you know what the way that the book's written? Is that your natural style? Obviously, you said before, you've told me that you've been writing and creating for years. Do you have, like, a few different ways of doing things? And The White Bobbitus is your favourite one? Or is that one aspect of your creativity, that kind of thing?
I've always had various methods and various styles, whether they've been a rhyming style or whether it's been in the form of a play or in the form of a script or in the form of a novella. But I think I'm only ever in the future going to write 32-page picture books that are 58 stanzas long that are written in perfect ballads, because I've got a blueprint that works. And I remember there was a thing that the comedian Jerry Seinfeld said, gave him up with this quote once, and I thought it was a really, really good quote. If you're good at one thing, you don't need another.
Yeah.
And as I was saying before, there's been so many picture book writers who have then went to write a play or a short story or a novel or a film, whatever it may be. And I've got no problem doing that. But let's say, for example, Roger Hargreaves, who created The Mr. Men, if there was like a gritty, like, hard hitting novel that was by Roger Hargreaves, people just think, what, the guy who's done The Mister Men? he's got his thing.
Yeah.
I suppose it's like when actors are typecast. There's certain actors who are typecast to be a guru. There's actors who are typecast of being a little bit goofy and a little bit quirky and a little bit wacky sort of thing. But I think if you're typecast as a storyteller works, and it works for you, and you've got a formula and format that works, which I feel like I've got now, that's what I'm going to do, and that's how I'm going to carry on doing it. But I would say to anyone who's listening to this, who wanted to become a writer or thought about writing, is if you feel that you've got something that you are comfortable with, don't be afraid of trying something else. Or if you've got a couple of different methods that you're not comfortable with, but you still enjoy doing it, it's something that you should just carry on doing, because it's something that you want to do. You have to do it for yourself first.
Yeah.
And then the same with anything in life, it'll find a way.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, actually. You just covered it, but I spoke to a playwright recently, David Moorhead, on one of my earlier podcasts, and he always said, get writing. And what you said is, quoting Steinbeck, is write. Get it out. There's a cathartic element, there's an expressive element. You might have different things that you feel like you need to get out, but don't be afraid of that one thing that you are really good at or that you get acknowledged for, and saying, that's my niche. And what you've said is, for years you've been doing this and you found that niche, and that's what you're going to do it. And you still might need to write other things, but you're going to focus on that, and that's what's going to be your kind of your main objective moving forward. I think that the art of writing is, you know, you've told me that you used to take time off work to write. How do you write? How do you fit it into your day? Is there a time in the day when you're better at writing? How does that work for you?
Well,
because you've got kids, you've got another job, what you do. So how does it work for you?
Well, the reason why, I know you're going to touch on the taxi trade. The reason why I came on the taxi is in 2000, in August 2000, which is coming up to 22 years ago. And I had little ideas that I was scrapping around. And before that, I'd done your bog standard 9-to-5 office jobs. And if you get like a sort of like a real creative pang of something that you think, you know what, this will work, I need to get this down. You know, if you're in a 9-to-5 office, you can't just stop. You can't just stop what you're doing. And that's why I wanted a job that I could work of a night, so I could write of a day, but I could write of a day and work of a night. And people usually say about I'm working 24/7, or I'm doing this 24/7. But if you'd asked most people how many hours are in a week, I don't think they'd say 168 off the top of the head. But from 0-100 hours on Monday to 23:59 on the Sunday, there's in those 168 hours, I think, okay, well, I'll do me 40-45 hours a week work on the taxis, whether it's from 3 o'clock in the morning till 6 o'clock in the morning, or it's nine o'clock in the morning till 12 o'clock in the afternoon. For me, I used to work around my writing, and there'd be an awful lot of the time where I could just do a bog standard 9-to-5 job, really. But there was one time where I just couldn't sleep, and there was an idea that I had where I thought this'll work. And I ended up writing maybe 150 stanzas and only using 3 or 4 of them.
Mm.
And I was up from 3 o'clock in the morning to 7 o'clock in the morning. So I obviously then was really tired, had some breakfast, went to sleep or whatnot. And because I'd then missed the whole day, I was then working all night on a Saturday night. And that was the beauty of the taxi trade, of what I'd missed out on what would be conventional work hours.
Yeah.
I'd then make up for on what people would call in general unsociable hours. But your unsociable hours, it depends what your social life is.
Yeah.
That depends what is sociable and what is unsocial.
I have a notebook with me all the time. I'm a teacher, and you know, my days are quite rigid, but I always have a notebook with me, and if I get an idea, a thought, a poem, a story, an idea for a story or an article or whatever, I write it down. And I mean, even this podcast's part of what I would call the doorstep mile, which is something I've spoken of before. Like, getting started is often the biggest obstacle. in things. And it sounded like you got a job in the taxis where the writing and the taxis were almost like yin and yang. Do you fit it together nicely?
Absolutely. I totally concur with that. The taxi trade and my taxi family, to be honest with you, the guys who I've met on the cabs, although we're all sort of rivals for work for where the next job comes from, they've been massively supportive of what it is that I do, and they're a real good bunch of lads. It's a good it's good for that side of things, but it is the type of job, if you're comfortable with working like early hours in the morning and you're picking drunken vagrants up at 3 o'clock on a Saturday night with kebab juice all over the face and stuff like that, you know, it's of a Saturday night, really late of a Saturday night, you're hourly in triple that of what they are daytime. But if there was a Saturday night where I had an idea and I thought this really, really works and I've got to get this down, and it may not come, nothing may come from it. I've got thousands of hours worth of writing that leads to
nothing. Yeah, to something. No, but that's what art's like, isn't it? You can put loads in and then can't you, and then like, oh no, that doesn't work for me, and then that little snippet might develop into something later on, you know what I mean? That's fine. But like, I think that structural thing you've got about it all with the taxis and the creativity fitting in, you know, I think that's really good. Yeah, you recently went into a local school in Netherton, in St Benedict's,
that's
right. And you went in to talk about the white barbadus. How did that go?
It was daunting, but it was brilliant. The headmaster there, Mike Phillips, he was great. He guided me around. We thought it'd be better for me to get my nerves out by doing the nursery and the reception first, but then that was just a bad idea doing them first, because the nursery and reception kids, they're great for the white barbadus if they sat on your knee and you're reading it to them, or like sort of nan and grandad or mum and dad sat at the end of the bed reading the story to them, as you've done to with your son. Sat on his grandad's knee and showing him the pictures and going through the story. Yeah. But when you get a bigger cohort of 3 and 4 year olds together, one's got the fingers up one of the other one's noses and they're eating each other's hair and just rolling around on the carpet, and it was a baptism of fire.
Yeah,
it really, really was.
However, so were you reading from the book?
I was reading to the book and showing them the pictures, and then so because year one and two were doing phonics at the time, I had to do nursery, reception, and then straight to year three. And when I seen year three were doing The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and I thought, oh my God, they're doing them. I'm going in and reading my new fresh picture book to kids who were reading C.S. Lewis. And I thought, oh, how am I going to handle this? And this little girl, and I remember her name was Ella, because she said, hello, my name's Ella, what's your name? I said, my name's Christopher. She gave me a little fist bump and said, pleased to meet you, Christopher. She said, are you the author who's coming to read to us? And I said, yeah, I am. And she went, oh, lovely. I've been looking forward to this all week. And that extinguished any nerves that I had. Yeah. As soon as she said, I've been looking forward to this all week, I thought, these kids want me to be here.
Yeah.
They want me to be here, and they want me to read to them. And then after that, it was fine. And they asked some really good questions as well about, you know, what should they be reading, in my opinion, what for their different age groups, and how or what should they be writing at this moment if they wanted to become a writer. There was one girl who said, I'd really like to become a writer of some sort. What would your advice be for me now as a 10-year-old? If I want to be a writer in the future, I said, do you keep a diary? And she said, no, not really. I said, well, keep a diary. I said, and if you can keep a diary and you can keep to it, that'll show the focus, the desire and the tenacity that you've got. There's 365 days in a year and 300 of them, nothing will happen. Nothing at all. You'll just get up, you'll have your breakfast, you'll go to school, you'll come home, you'll have your egg and chips, you'll go to bed. Nothing will happen. But if in 65 days, that's 9 weeks, something happens, you've got so much material there that you'll find. And even in the nothingness, you might find So you might find something. So just keep writing, but to keep a diary. She said, can I just make a note of that? So she had this little pad and paper. And I said, if you don't mind me asking, what are you writing there? She said, I'm writing down, ask mum to buy me a diary.
Yeah.
So if nothing else comes from the experience, the fact that there's a little girl who doesn't keep a diary, who's going to keep a diary because she wants to be a writer. She may be a journalist in the future. She, you know, she may be a playwright. She may be a novelist. She may be, and I think that's what it is that I've wanted to set out to do, to get people talking to each other and
inspired, because creativity, over the last decade in particular, there's been a lot of moves away from creativity in schools, because creativity, it's hard to quantify in the sense of what might be called more traditional measurable approaches to education, which I think is a terrible thing. You know, you've got secondary schools now, which like they're cutting back on like music and drama and all that. You know, I think it's terrible. But going back to what you've just said, I forget the guy who wrote Millions, Liverpool author, I forget his name.
Frank Cottrell Boyce.
I spoke to him years ago. He came in and spoke to pupils in one of my previous schools about like being a writer. And he said, keep a diary. He said, if you're not a writer or you want to be a writer or you want to try, he said, keep a diary and write down three. I've mentioned this on another podcast. Write down three things that have happened that day from someone else's perspective, that someone else has experienced. So then you're commenting on their experiences. And it's those little things like having a notebook, setting time aside. Right, I've got an idea. Let's see where it goes. It might go nowhere. Writing things down, and from that you might get narratives. You know, you were saying before about Steinbeck, just get writing, then later you can shape it, or you might come up with a plot first.
That's 100% right.
And again, it depends on the style, but that inner critic, and I want to come to the inner critic. I was going to ask you later, like, what advice have you got for creatives, and we might look at that in a bit more detail. You just mentioned with the diary idea, but how do you deal with the inner critic? To what extent do you have that inner critic going, this is crap, what are you doing, wasting your time? Do you have those experiences?
Yes, as soon as my inner critic comes in and I feel like I'm forcing the issue, that's when it's time to that's the time to put the pen down and think, okay, your inner critic's winning. But it's the same with anything. It's about confidence. It's having confidence, and I know we've played together, haven't we? With the cricket, I know that you've been an opening batsman, and there'll be times where you'll have faced four or five balls and thought, oh, I don't even belong here. I shouldn't even be here. Why am I even holding the cricket bat? You know, and there'll be other times where you've drove a couple of nice boundaries and you've faced 40 or 50 balls and no one's got anywhere near getting you out, and the inner critic goes then.
Yeah.
The inner critic goes, and I suppose it's the same. It's the same with anyone in any walk of life, whether you're a sportsman or you're a journalist, a politician, a public speaker, whatever it is that one's doing. For me personally, the vast majority of stuff that I've written is inaudible. And the grammar's awful, and it's all over the place, and it doesn't make sense, and it just looks completely ridiculous. But there's other times when I've looked and I've thought, this really works. I suppose it's just about finding the balance. One's inner critic can be a good servant, but be a terrible master.
Yeah, do you say that about the mind? But yeah. You're right. It's about knowing when to say, right, you're all helping me here with this and I'm not in the right mood, but not letting it dominate.
Yeah, I'm not.
Because there might be times when you go, right, I'm going to write a couple of pages here. I'm not really feeling it, but I'm going to write a couple. And then after that, them two pages, I'll move away if I'm still not feeling it.
I personally don't think you should give yourself any sort of time of how many pages. It should just be a case of, right, I'm going to have a little write, I'm going to have a little write down, and all of your little notes and your things that you've scrapped about with and stuff, and then just, you may even just be reading over old stuff.
Yeah.
Reading over old stuff and think, oh, I can do something with that, or I can do something with this, and then it's something that you can then chop and change from there, which is a good thing to do. Most writers have a thing what they call a beat sheet. Now, BEAT, like a beat, you know, like the beat of a drum. So your beat sheet will be source A will go to source B to source C to source D. So. Mm. So you, one comment, one sentence, yeah. one thing that'll happen that'll go into the next one, and these beats will go on, and then you may then find that then it'll come to the end, and then you can, from source A to source B, your story will then go from source B. It may just take a completely different turn, and it may go somewhere else, and that's just about allowing yourself to have that flow, really.
To what extent would you say that it's better to have it planned out first, the plot as it were, and then you fill it in, or would you write and see how it goes, or elements of both?
I'd say elements of both. I think it comes down purely to the individual. And it depends on the length of something that you're writing as well. If you know how you want your plot or how you want your story to end, you've got something to aim for.
There's a
target there, but if you've got then more to say before you reach that target, it may look like you're trying to force the penultimate before you come to the end. But rather than then forcing the penultimate, let's say for example you've got the end and it was a novella and it ends on, and this is page 300 and you're up to page 290, but you know how page 300 is going to be, and you're writing 10 pages, but you think these 10 pages are going to be 40 pages, but you know it can only be 300 pages long, but you've gone over. That's when your editing comes in then. Mm. But rather than thinking, I'm getting these 30 pages squeezed in to 10 pages because it has to be 300, overwrite and edit. Always, with any forms of writing, you're always overwrite and edit. I mean, as I say, my White Barbados is 58 stanzas. That's probably being cut down from over 100. Some have been similes that maybe haven't rhymed. The vast majority would have been in perfect balance, but they may have taken the story off on to a tangent where I wouldn't want to go. But I've just carried on. I've just carried on with it, and then just taken little bits out because I've wanted it to be as simplistic as possible. Mm. As simplistic as possible, and I like to think when people read The White Barbados, they'd look and think, this is easy, I could do that. I take that as a compliment. Because it does look easy and it does look simple, and it just looks like it's got that easy, simple flow to it. When I got the final copy of the prototype and I was completely happy with what I seen, I thought, it looks simple, it looks easy, it looks like anyone can do it. The footballer Johan Cruyff once said, the most difficult thing in life is simplicity.
That's a good quote, isn't it?
And it is a really good quote, and that's what I wanted it to do. I just wanted it to look simple and easy and free-flowing more than anything.
I think it definitely comes across like that. You can tell it's something that's been, you know, it's developed over time. Just to bring things to a close, I think we're going to do a separate podcast on the taxi side of things, because this has been a great discussion, and I think that we need to do, I want this to do justice to itself about the White Barbados, but also discussions of the taxi trade, etc., in another podcast. Just to finish off, two quick ones. The first one is, how, from 2016, when someone said, right, this needs to be published, what happened over the next 5 years, very briefly, before it was actually published? Because that's a long time, isn't it? What were the stages?
What happened was, Kevin Doran, who's an old friend of mine, who's a managing director of an investment bank, he was the senior investor into this project. He was looking at different business models, and he wanted to do something that was called a freemium business model. And it was something that the people who created Super Mario done, got the image rights for Super Mario, but give all the software away to arcades all around the world, because they knew that in the future, if they had the technology to have their own games console, everyone would know who Super Mario was, they'd know what he'd look like, and as soon as they developed their own, it would close arcades around the world, because people would just have them in their own house. And so, although the late 1970s, early 1980s, there was arcades with video games everywhere, and they must have thought, this is great, we've got this technology on a motherboard for free. Little did they know, all they were doing is they were creating an empire for Nintendo.
Yeah.
They were creating it, and when Nintendo, they were already working on those Nintendo entertainment systems, so no one's going to travel 2 miles to an arcade to put coins into a machine when they can plug it into the house and play it themselves. So that sort of, that idea, that business model, was what we wanted to do with the Barbados, to be able to come up with an e-book that was linked to a tangible copy. So those, from 2016 up until 2020, it was about trying to find the right way to use the freemium business model to just give the book away so it was shared to everyone, but we could have the license and rights of the, and merchandise rights of the face of the Barbados, etc. And then in the start of 2021, because my thing was always, and as we touched on earlier, it was about getting it right and then getting it shared before there was even any thought of any sort of profit. So then 2021, the idea of then getting it right, what Kevin's done is he set up an Instagram advert that was put into feeds through the collected data that Instagram have got, for anyone who was interested in drawing and illustrating and writing and whatever it be. There was 4 candidates that we all commissioned. A guy called Stuart Galligan, Will Richardson, Kimmy Day, and Tanya Langner. Now, all 4 of them were brilliant. These all 4 that we commissioned, and I'd work with the other 3 any time, any day of the week. And if 10 years ago, I would have snapped someone's hand off to work with any of the other 3, the work was absolutely brilliant. And I couldn't laud them enough of how good they were. But I wanted to work with Tanya. And the reason why I wanted to work with Tanya is because she was never really a developed illustrator. She was a concept designer that wanted to be an illustrator and wanted to develop this, and she's an absolute perfectionist. She lives in Bath with her husband, Nick, and her 2 children, and she's originally from Austria, and it was just something that she wanted to do. And I found that we just worked so well together. We worked so well together, and the whole of 2021 was, she comes up with a thing called thumbnails, which is like one big sheet of between all of the 32 pages and how how the start will look like, how the ends will look like, and there'll be little scribbles. But before she comes up with them, I'll say, I want this to look like this on one page, this on the next page, and then she brings my ideas to life. So I've said page one is for the thing that's called front matters, which you'll have who the copyright belongs to. And the end page is back matters, where you'll have your copyright and stuff like that on, which is page 32. So then when you have then page 2 and 3, 4 and 5, 6 and 7, and so on, up until page 30 and 31. They're how the spreads go on the beat sheet. Every single spread, I had a description, a vision of how I wanted it to look like, and where I wanted the text to go, and where I wanted the characters and the creatures to go, and how I wanted to flow from there. And it was like Tanya had come right into my head. Tanya Langner, was like, she came right into my head, and then what was in my head came out onto the page. It was just, it couldn't have been more perfect for how I wanted it to be.
The illustrations are excellent though, aren't they? And they do complement things well, and it's good to see that you've got that kind of understanding. It's hard to explain it, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is, yeah.
And then that's 5 years before you get the book published, so... It's quite a long process, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I met Tanya was fully on board on March of last year.
So was that late in the process?
Yeah, no, that late in the process, sorry. Yeah, so Tanya, we only started looking for an illustrator. We started looking for an illustrator in 2021.
There's 4 or 5 years up to that stage.
Up to that stage, yeah. When we found Tanya in March of 2021, and we started working through Zoom calls, obviously because of COVID and whatnot. So we're working through doing stuff through Zoom. Me and Tanya and Kevin of what we want to look like, and the flow of the story, and it was pretty much flawless all the way through until in September. Because the company that Kevin works for, AJ Bell, sponsor a stadium in Manchester, Sale Sharks were playing Bath, and then so we were invited up, and I met Tanya for the first time. So she'd virtually finished the vast majority of the illustrations, and then to get it then published. It's about then transferring the right files over to KDP from Amazon, and making sure the bleeds were right. And ideally, we wanted it to be out before Christmas. But the first thing was, we'd rather it be right and out afterwards. So although it was published on the 1st of January 2022, but it's going to be fully launched with the website on the 14th of February, we thought, you know, it's a modern day love story for children.
Yes, indeed. Do you know the publishers? Are they your publishers, or have you used someone else?
The thing is, it's published by Barbados Limited.
Right, so that's the company, but it's Amazon. It's on Amazon as well.
It's on Amazon, so it can be purchased from Amazon. So KDP, Kindle Digital Publishing, Kindle Digital Publishing, they do all the printing and all the copying of it. But the actual publisher who they work with and work on behalf of is Barbados Limited, which is an independent publishing company. This was something that Kevin set up. We had an agreement at the start that the words, the cadence, the flow was mine. That was my bag. The visuals, the illustrations was Tanya's bag, and the marketing side of things and getting it out there was then Kevin's bag, and we all pretty much agree on what's best for the book going forward. If Kevin and Tanya were about to say to me, "Oh no, Chris, this doesn't work. Whatever you want to do, I take it on board." Or if Tanya had an idea that me and Kevin didn't agree with, or vice versa, we all take on board.
You can have that critical friendship.
That's exactly what it is, the critical friendship, which is a good way of putting it. Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, it's been like a long road, but it's out there, and I would recommend people buy it, read it, buy it for others. If you're stuck in your ways and you're an adult, you should read it as well. But it's a great book. Well done and congratulations. Final thing for creatives, you've mentioned getting a diary, keeping going. Anything else that you'd say to people out there, or have we pretty much covered it up?
I think to just finish on, for anyone who's listening to this who is creative, don't be frightened of your creativity, no matter how silly or how bizarre or how wayward it may seem. Just go with it. Mm. Just go with it, and you'll find the vast majority of the stuff that you write, you will think it's rubbish yourself. Mm. But when you keep rewriting and rereading and looking over different stuff, you'll find little pockets, little nuggets of treasure in your trove of trash, sort of thing. I think that's. But another thing I'd say as well is, and keep reading as well.
Yeah.
The thing is, more you read, be curious.
Yeah. Be curious. That's another big one. Chris, been a pleasure. You might expect me to say this anyway, but I asked Chris to do this because I'd read The White Bobbitus. And I do really recommend that you go out and get it. All the details for the White Bobbitus website, where you can buy it. Please support this podcast any way you can. And Chris, thanks again. And we'll see everyone soon. Cheers.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you.
Last time with Paul Dorgan, I forgot to include a link to his music. So I'm including it in the notes to this. So please listen to Paul Dorgan's music. It's really good. Thanks, everyone. Sorry about all the pots and pans in the background there. I would like to have my own place, a studio in the future, but one can only dream. Thank you very much for Chris for that, and don't forget to support me through Ko-fi and to follow me on Twitter. Have a great day, everyone.